when you open the bottle and you drink the wine, it speaks for itself. Is it, you know, a wine that's made for food? Yes. Those types of wines are tend to be more rustic or have a little bit more body. Are there wines that are just pure out hedonistic pleasure? Sure, there's wines like that that maybe from California that are more cocktail wines, or wines that are just big jammy fruit bombs. And those, I think, appeal to a certain group of people as well. I think the wines that Barter House specializes in is more of these food-friendly, you know, rustic style, biodynamic, organic wines that tend to be a bit more earthy, come from someplace. So you can almost taste the terroir. You can almost feel this guy, this Sancerre, was grown in this slaty, rocky soil. And so to me, that's the exciting part, that the wine feels like it comes from someplace.
Thank you for joining this afternoon's program of At the Root of It. I'm your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, and it's the 21st of December, and we're just inching ever closer to Christmas Day. And please bear with me, I am slowly losing my voice, but we are going to begin the weekend wine recap. With latest news, the Wall Street Journal reports that Brown-Forman Corp., the maker of Jack Daniel's whiskey, has put its wine business up for sale, becoming the latest small wine operation to hit the auction block at a challenging time for some parts of the industry. Brown-Forman, which is based in Louisville, Kentucky, has hired Rothschild to run the auction process, the people said. Private equity firms and other global wine and spirits firms are expected to consider the business, which is unlikely to fetch much more than a few hundred million dollars. It's also possible that only part of the business will be sold. Separately, Constellation Brands Incorporated, the world's biggest vintner by sales, is close to selling the bulk of its non-U.S. wine portfolio to an unknown buyer. That deal, should it not fall apart, could come this week and fetch between $300 million and $400 million. Brown-Forman's wine division ranks number 10 in size among wine companies in the U.S., according to Wine Business Monthly. The unit sells about 4.5 million cases in the U.S. and another 1.5 outside the country per year. And in the market feed, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, OLCC, unanimously passed a rule Friday requiring 45 days prior notice and a public hearing before implementing any new markups, fees, or surcharges on distilled spirits, according to the Distilled Spirits Council, which applauded the measure and called it a win for good government. The OLCC's new rule on spirits markups is an excellent example of transparent government, said Peter Cressy, the president of the Distilled Spirits Council. The OLCC and Chairman Lang are to be commended for their excellent leadership and commitment to good government and responsible business practices, end quote. The new measure adopted by the OLCC under Chapter 845 on the retail price of distilled spirits includes four provisions required before the commission may implement a surcharge or change in the markup percentage for spirits that would result in price increase for the public. The first of those provisions is providing at least 45 days public notice before such a price increase takes effect. The second is providing the opportunity for a submission of written comments regarding the proposed price increase. Third, conduct a public meeting for the purpose of receiving verbal comment regarding the proposed price increase. And lastly, consider any written or verbal comments before implementing such a price increase. That's all today for the Week in Wine, and we will be back this afternoon with my guest, one of our sponsors, actually, who you heard before the Week in Wine, named Brian DeMarco of the Barter House. So please stay tuned.
Thank God it's Friday. Keep the heads ringing.
And work your body down. No time to fall. So get up, get a move on, and get your groove on. It's the DRE, the spectacular. In a party, I go for your neck, so call me Blackula. As I drain a nigga's juggle of vein and maintain the leaf bloodstain, so don't complain.
That was an indulgent pleasure. Thanks, Jack, for that one. That was our version of Christmas holiday music here at the Heritage Radio Network. And a special request from my guest this afternoon, Brian DeMarco of the Barter House. Welcome. You're looking very dapper today.
Thank you, Miss E. How are you? Can you hear me well or not?
I can hear you fantastically, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm probably the one that's a little scratchy, so you're going to be doing the bulk of the talking today, Mr. DeMarco.
Well, okay, I'll hold my own if I can.
Okay. Well, look at this three-piece suit going on here. What's the occasion?
Well, I'm going to give a little plug out for my boy, Duncan Quinn. He gave me the bespoke suit treatment. It only took 11 months for it to be made, but it was a barter deal and a little cash, a little wine, and Mr. Quinn is drinking well, and I'm apparently looking good.
So. Mm-hmm, that is true.
So, yeah, a little shout out for my boy, Duncan.
Excellent. Cool. I wanted to start today's program because couple weeks ago I had the opportunity to go to a screening of Escaping Robert Parker, and I figured we'd start here given that it is current and in the news and something that I've recently seen, which you have a role in. And this is one of Ed Burley's new films.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Burley is... I think he's a talented individual who was a well-trained Yale lawyer who decided that law was not his thing and became a filmmaker. And I know he had done some short format stuff that had met with a little bit of praise. And he approached me through my winemaker, Julian, hailing from Jules Wines.
Mm-hmm.
And about 4 years ago, the idea was to follow a young winemaker around and basically trace the origins of the wine from a grape on a vine to a retail store in New York City and kind of follow the journey, not only the journey of the wine, but the journey of the winemaker and the people involved, and really show the behind the scenes of what it takes for a small producer to sort of compete on the national or international level. And what it ended up becoming was this, this interesting sort of story about this winemaker, and I was sort of the foil as sort of his importer and the voice of reason, or sort of the naysayer to some of what Julian wanted to accomplish, from this sort of grandiose, I want to conquer the world thing. And I think what Ed found interesting in his rendition of the story was there needed to be a deeper foil, and mm-hmm. there needed to be somebody sort of to root for and root against. And I'm not necessarily sure Robert Parker became, he was always this underlying storyline within the movie, but it really wasn't a prominent piece of, how should I say it? It really wasn't the story until we needed it to become the story.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
when we started, when Ed started to show the movie around, I was, again, this bit player that had maybe a few moments of screen time, and, to see it 3 or 4 years down the road, and I realized he had interviewed me maybe, 20 minutes here, an hour there, and I remember one time he asked me, do you have the blue blazer that you wore in 2008? I said... I guess I'll see if I can, dig it up. And he's like, yeah, okay. And, and sure, wear those glasses that you had. I said, okay, I'll see if I can find them. So 2 years later, I'm trying to, reshoot something that, so as far as filmmaking and, I'm not so sure it was this holistic, grand spectacle, but it definitely, as a documentary goes, it did trace 4 years of people's lives and sort of show like the progression of how a movie gets made, as well as how people's lives progress mm-hmm. over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Also really showed that connectivity between the urban marketplace and the countryside where these wines are produced, and kind of those two factors, which sometimes I think gets forgotten in terms of people's consumption of goods and how it really goes down at the vineyard, and how much work it is for these winemakers to really make a living.
Well, I mean, I know you've done a few harvests, Miss Erin, so you mm-hmm. understand the labor it takes. And for my part, I usually show up for the photo op and cut a few grapes and then really focus on the blending and sort of the marketing and the positioning of the brand. And so for us, it was, you know, it was kind of this watching Ed go through the process was a bit painful because, you know, I wanted the best for him and the best for the project. But meanwhile, I wanted to sell more wine and I wanted to be part of something that was hopefully, you know, strategically a win for all parties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But,
and then in terms of the beginning kind of concept, which Ed started with, and the idea that Robert Parker put such pressure on winemakers and then how their sales will get into the marketplace. What is your current feeling? I mean, given that was a beginning concept 4 years ago, and I think in the past, I'd say 5 to 8 years, certainly, there's been a little bit of a shift in the past 5 years with respect to people's importance on ratings and points.
I think it's one thing to criticize the man or the process, and in doing so, I will give him his props and his due because, you know, when I was a young wine professional or when I decided to start my company, a lot of the influence that I had, especially specifically in Bordeaux, came from reading Parker. And if you even look at, there's a spot in the movie where I have a very well thumbed through Robert Parker Bordeaux book, and I have various tabs, you know, little stickies that I put on from all the wines that I tried.
Mm-hmm.
And there's hundreds and hundreds of tabs in this book. And so I've read it cover to cover. And so to say that he wasn't an influence on me would be just not true. But with respect to that, I used it for my own personal edification. And I said, you know, I agree with him here. And
right.
Here I have no idea what he's thinking. And so I use it to hone my own palate and to decide for myself based on, you know, reading his reviews of certain wines. I mean, some places I had never been, and other places through his writings I was able to imagine, you know, his experience. And subsequently through my, you know, business activity, I've been able to go to many of these, you know, chateaux and meet a lot of the key players in the business years later and have my own experiential understanding of what Parker was talking about.
Mm-hmm,
but I think that if you go specific to your question or more to your comment, you know, 10 years ago or even 15 years ago, Robert Parker was gospel on many topics pertaining to wine, the way wine was reviewed, and then furthermore, the way wine was being made. And so the thing where the place where I kind of disagree, and I think this is kind of, you know, you can read a lot of people are kind of attacking this point where the Parkerization of wine, where they're taking wines that were traditionally, you know, may have been high in acidity or wines that really spoke to their terroir or the place that they came from. And they said, well, these wines aren't selling on the international market. We need to make wines that are more Robert Parker type
mm-hmm,
wines
mm-hmm.
so we can get better ratings, so we can make better sales, so we can be more famous and we can make more money.
Right.
And so it kind of took the market by storm, but in this slow, gradual process, because you realize it is an agricultural product and you can't just change, you know, vintage to vintage. You just can't change your house style, but some places did.
And yeah, that's true.
Specifically South America. And even in some cases, Spain, they've been making wine a traditional way for, you know, 100 years. And in the last 10, they've done a dramatic shift to be more fruit driven, more oak, in terms of, you know, the American oak or even French oak, and decided to make a style of wine that would hopefully garner Parker points. And I remember even reading that certain winemakers would say, well, this wine will get 91 points in Parker. We
mm-hmm.
already know that because we've made it exactly like another wine that gets 91 points. So if you want to buy into this, you know we're going to get these points.
Right.
And it was really kind of shocking to me that the whole business model was being driven by this.
Right, yeah. Well, and you mentioned South America and Spain, but, you know, in addition, even in Bordeaux, you know, that was something that you could watch wines and taste some old Bordeaux and see how the style had shifted in some chateau. And, you know, certainly there's vintage changes which affect that as well. But then there has been a little bit of a calling back towards the original house style at some of these chateaux in Bordeaux.
Well, and I think that's a direct backlash to, you know, when people lose their way, or when you kind of, you know, chase a trend, it's a business decision. And then there's this, you know, the people that held true to their calling, you know, can pound their chest and puffery and say, oh, well, you know, we never changed. But, you know, there's what was once cool is now cool, not cool again, and vice versa. Like, you have to, you know, yeah. I don't blame those chateaux or those folks that made wine like that, but I do really appreciate seeing a return to terroir, or you know, if these are the type of wines that are made in your region, we'll make those type of wines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, have you established your own theory or your own idea of how a particular point system would work?
Well, you know, I guess there's a lot of ways to approach it. I'll talk, I think, initially about this sort of false cutoff, which I think is what's wrong with the current rating system. And, you know, a lot of people don't believe that a wine has any merit until it is 90 points or above.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think part of the misnomer is that, you know, everybody can rate something 90 points. It doesn't start. I mean, I don't know what kind of college student you were, but when I got a B+, I was pretty psyched. So if you were thinking a B+ is 85 to 89 points, those wines are well made. They're critically acclaimed in terms of, you know, they're better than average, much better than average.
Right. Yeah.
And I posit that if you were to drink 89 rated wine the rest of your life, it would be a pretty charmed life.
Right, exactly. Yeah, pretty pleasing.
Yeah.
Right, so it's like if we're getting, looking at that, and a B is an 84, then even in magazines such as, you know, Wine and Spirits, Wine Spectator, they have their own ratings that are published in those magazines, mm-hmm. as well, independent of Parker's rating. So then when you look at those in the lower ranges of the 80s, it is a little bit it's something that gets right. overlooked. Yeah,
I think it's not only does it get overlooked, I think it really hurts the consumer, because the consumer, in many regards, doesn't know any better. And if they were drinking an 85 or an 88 rated wine, they probably would love it, and it would be probably a better value for them.
Mm-hmm.
It would be something they could get consistently at a specific price,
mm-hmm.
and it wouldn't be, you know, this trophy hunting. I think the real, you know, where I started collecting as a private collector before I even started my business, was I would look at the Parker scores of 90 rated wines or above that were below $30 in price. So that this was Lexus of high rated, low cost wines.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something to seek out.
Right.
And now every day I get an email or some sort of news blast from a retailer saying 90 point wine, you know, $15.99 or $29.99. And the thing that I notice is that there's so much competition, but the consumer doesn't understand that a 90 point Argentine wine is completely different than a 90 point French wine. Now they may even both be Malbec, but to compare a Cahors to, say, you know, a Mendozan, you know, Malbec is soup and nuts, but there's the same grape. It's, you know, their styles are similar, but one is just made completely different than the other. And so I think it's hard to, it's for the consumer even to understand, mm-hmm. you know, should it be the same 100-point scale universally, or should it be 100 points within a category, or should it be 10 points within a category?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm rating Australian wine, should the rating system be against similar Australian wines, or should we be rating Australian wines versus California wines? And I think not. I think there should be, you know, within its category, within its subset, there's a best of class.
Right.
And then
okay.
maybe if we're saying, well, I like Bordeaux style wines, maybe we can rate Bordeaux type wines against other Bordeaux type wines from around the globe. But still, it should be a fair comparison, an apples to apples comparison.
Right. Okay. So each of these different subsets is put into their own context, as opposed to an international display of wines that all fall within a similar price point. that these wines, regardless of
price
point, are more.
I mean,
just
we're making
sector.
This. So I don't have the. Like
I that. Know, but it's interesting to think about because you'd almost have to kind of clear a whole slate and rejig how this would.
I mean, I'd start over. I mean, honestly, yeah. I mean, we're having an open, freeform dialogue here, which is awesome. And but the reality is that, you know, I'm sure that many people have thought of this. I'm sure the Wine Spectator even has its own idea of how to fix this, or they're part of the problem. I'm not sure, but you know, you can't. You know, there's one thing to say this is a Best Buy. There's another thing to say that this wine derives pleasure while providing value, and those kind of things. There's a need for that. I think the press or the wine press specifically should continue to do that and make it very easy for consumers to get their hands on good quality, fairly priced wine. But when we get into this sort of shades of gray, I've seen people at wine auctions with their laptops doing an algorithm on what one Parker point means in we're talking about Bordeaux now, but one Parker point means in terms of the price quality relationship. For example, if something is a Haubrion in a certain year, a 92, and then it goes to a 94, well then maybe that's worth, you know, each point's worth maybe $50 to $100 in the price of the
of
wine.
The wholesale price of the wine, yeah.
Right. And it's really bizarre because if someone says, okay, well, that vintage, a 2005 Bordeaux versus a 2004 Bordeaux, there's going to be, you know, in many regards, 30 to 50% price differences. And there's a scant amount of people in this world. You and I are, of course, some of those people that can probably tell the difference between those wines. Many of the people that would ever buy those wines are trophy hunters or people hoping for arbitrage. So I feel like we're all trading the same wine and hoping to make our, you know, 10 or 15 or 20% on the backside of flipping it. And that the people actually drinking those wines, if they were really a drinker, they'd be buying the 2001s, the 2004s, the 2007s, sure. Which would be sort of the off vintage, even though the wines are still exceptional quality. I wouldn't say they're value driven. $100 a bottle, it's still pretty pricey.
Sure. Well, on that note, we're going to take a short break and come back and continue this conversation. We also have a wine from the Barter House book, a Sauvignon Blanc from Kerner Estate. So be right back. Creep on in, on in. Kinda broke, seeming young, so all I got is fire. I got fire. Player, give me some brew and I might just chill. But I'm the type that likes to light another joint like Cypress Hill. I still do these spit loogies when I puff on it. I got some bucks on it, but it ain't enough on it. Go get the S-T-I-D-E-S. Nevertheless, I'm hella fresh, rolling joints like a cigarette. So fast across the table like ping pong. I'm gone, beating my chest like King Kong. And some wrap my lips around the 40. And when it comes to getting another stogie, fools all kicking like Shinobi. Know me, ain't my homie too. Begin with, it's too many hands to be. Probably let my friend hit bit. Unless you pull out the fat crispy $5 bill on the reel before it's history. Cause fools be having them vacuum lungs. And if you let them hit it for free, you hella dumb. Da dum dum. I come to school with a tailor on my earlobe. Avoiding all the flick teasers, skeezers, and weirdos. That be throwing off the land like where the bomb at. Give me $2, you take a puff and pass my bomb back. Suck up the dank like a slurpee. The serious bomb will make a nigga go delirious like Eddie Murphy. I got more growing pains than Maggie. Cause homies nag me to take the dank out of the bag. Why did hip hop used to be so much better?
I got fives on it right now.
Welcome back. You're listening to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, and I'm sitting here with Brian DeMarco of the Barter House, who's one of our kind sponsors to the Heritage Radio. And we had just wrapped up the previous segment talking a bit about a documentary that Brian is featured in as is one of his wine producers called Escaping Robert Parker. And then how the systems of points and ratings has affected us as consumers and in trade as well. Now, let me ask you this question. Have you ever tasted a 100-point wine before?
I've been fortunate enough to have tasted 700-point wines. And it's probably more, but at that point I wasn't cognizant of it, or I was too drunk to remember. But no, I've had some Bordeaux and some Burgundy that were rated 100 points, and I think two California wines that were rated 100 points.
Uh-huh.
And
life-changing?
from a financial aspect, yes. I thought, after I drank them, I thought about what I could have bought, or what we collectively could have bought with the
right.
money that we spent on those wines.
Yeah.
But no, I think it, again, you get down to this experiential and having access to those types of wines. I feel fortunate being in the business that I am, that I can, you know, even drink these wines. But the reality is that you want to make an excuse for the wine when it's 100 points and you're loving it. You want to make sure you get, you know, every ounce of it. You taste every ounce
right.
of it, because you're thinking, my God, you know, it's an agricultural product that is being viewed as, you know, the best of class.
Right.
But there's this other thought that, you know, I've had an 89 Haubrion, I think with Mr. Justin Christoph, who has actually been a guest on this show as well.
Yes, he has. And a little shout out to Riesling AC.
Riesling AC, my man Jay. but I think he brought one to dinner. We were at 11 Madison, and no one at the table knew that we had even opened this wine. I think we opened it blind. And I knew, and Justin knew, and we, obviously because he brought it. And the wine was spectacular. But once the guests we had, who I won't mention, knew we were drinking 89 Haubrion, they started to flip out. They were like, oh my God, like, I can't believe there wasn't more fanfare, we didn't roll out the red carpet and
right.
we didn't announce that we were drinking. You know, we were having, you know, a prefix meal at 11 Madison. I mean, the mood was right. And I swear that their opinion of the wine changed when they knew what we were drinking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They liked it and they thought it was amazing. But then when we knew it was 100-point wine, they went batshit crazy. And am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, you are. And it's actually really not that surprising either. But yeah.
That I said batshit crazy?
No, not that, you know, that people have a tendency to do that.
Yeah. And I think it leads into this sort of, you want more out of your heroes, and you want more out of your wine,
mm-hmm,
and
you see
something and you expect,
recognize that
exactly,
yeah,
expect
yeah.
a certain payout. And but I mean, to close that loop, I mean, I've been just as happy and just as satisfied having it, you know, a great, you know, off into Chateauneuf du Pape, or even a straight Cote de Rome with, you know, a big hearty, you know, winter meal. And so
mm-hmm.
you have a good beef stew or something, and have a decent red that kind of knocks your socks off. It is just as pleasurable in a different way.
Well, I say keep chewing at it a bit more and exploring how to bring this platform to the table next year or the year after. But
well, we should, you know, next time we do this, we'll have some smarter people, like some economists around us, and we'll have them help us with this rating system. I think we could make one that's pretty sexy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and not to mention the Asian market and how they're scooping up these high rated wines and then bringing that into the marketplace to see how to clean that slate too, because that's going backfire.
Wow, your kitchen's sinking today, huh? You throw some Asian in there and...
Always.
Perfect.
There's a lot of eyes on that right now, so it's
Indeed.
Hard to not bring it into conversation. Switching gears, you've recently launched a new company called Gotham Wine Group.
Well, it's, you know, Barterhouse still exists and lives and will still remain a sponsor to the Heritage Radio Network, and Happy Jack, our producer, can be rest assured that he will be well libated in the future. But through necessity and almost through personal connections with another company called Noble House Wines, we have decided it was better to forge ahead together, and we created the Gotham Wine Group, which is essentially two mid-sized importer wholesalers in New York City that realized that through strength in logistics and maybe strength in the front office and branding, that we could be stronger together and sort of fight the good fight. And I listened to your intro where, you know, a lot of these big liquor companies are spinning off the wine divisions because they're just, it's hard to run. The margins aren't the same as liquor, and it really requires a personal hand and really an understanding of the market and the way the wines fit. And I feel like it's an opportunity. While these companies are seeing it as something to divest, we see it as an opportunity. So we're excited about it. And I think 2011 will be, you know, good stuff for, and I don't see it, you know, yes, we're in this to make money and provide, you know, value. And, but I think it's, we're doing the right thing for the consumers, honestly, because without little guys or mid-sized players like us, you're going to see, I hate to say it, but sort of the blanding of, you know, the grocery storing of wine, and you're going to see big brands, and you're just going to see stuff that is sort of all tastes the same, and it's going to be almost like beer, and, you know, and we're kind of like the crowd.
What do you mean by that?
I love beer.
I do too, but I feel like they're all so different.
But I mean, the craft beer movement saved the beer business.
Okay.
Just like I think the small producer, small importer business is saving the wine business. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. for every, you know, Dogfish Head ale from Delaware or any sort of like, you know, Belgian beer that's coming across and is being poured by on tap at your local beautiful restaurant. We have to have the same thing in wine. And, you know, New York City is a perfect foil for that and the forum to showcase these kind of products. But, I mean, what I'm talking about is the Midwest and where you see grocery stores, you know, only buying brands that are advertising or that consumers recognize immediately. And it kind of, it hurts my business, but then again, it makes the people that believe in the small craft movement happier because, you know, our products aren't everywhere.
Right. And it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it does seem, based on polls, recent polls, that this grocery store movement in the state of New York might indeed go forward. So to see how that shifts and if it does shift anything in the industry. And especially how that might affect you.
Something for another show, I'm sure.
I'm sure, indeed. let's hone in on this wine that we brought today from New Zealand. Maybe not the most natural layup for a cold winter day, but it does feel really nice and refreshing right now. So,
this is from Kerner Estates, and Bruce and Joanne Kerner are our friends and ex-Hollywood people who wisely took their winnings from years of producing The Cosby Show and bought a farm down in New Zealand. And they're committed to doing organic farming and really sort of, I think they realized early on that selling their fruit was an option, and they did that for a number of years. And then when I think they met, you know, a certain time in their life, and they met us, who was a natural outlet for their wines, they decided to make more and more production that wasn't just for them and the neighbors.
Okay.
And so this Sauvignon Blanc we're drinking is a 2009.
Brand new.
Mm-hmm. And it's got a touch of oak on it, which is unusual, but it's not prominent.
Have they always done that in their Sauvignon?
They were doing it with the Chardonnay, but the Sauvignon, traditionally from this region, Marlboro, is mostly stainless steel fermented. I think these guys are thinking French. You know, this is if you tasted this blind, we would pick it from. I think I'd pick the fruit from Marlboro, but I think the winemaking style is from the Loire Valley, and so you know maybe I'm leaning towards things that I like, and so I.
No, but I recognize that with the Chardonnay, particularly even more so than the Sauvignon. But I do see what you're saying.
But I like the style. I think it's fresh and clean, but it has a little bit more body, and it can be considered almost a winter white.
It definitely has more of the kind of green citrus notes as opposed to the gooseberry notes, which is so trademark Marlboro. But this is lacking that a little bit, which I think that's why I like it more than.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, I think that they've got pigeonholed with I don't mean Kerner, but I think the New Zealand, mm-hmm. specifically Marlboro Savis, got pigeonholed as having this gooseberry, almost cat's pea, grassy, really, some would say fresh aromatics. I would say sort of over the top, in your face.
High acidity.
And elegant.
Bracing.
Not, you know, they're fine for a 100-degree day on the beach where you're just throwing it down, but I don't think it was really an intellectual wine or anything that you would, you know, I would say be unproud to drink, but
right.
Yeah, you know, it was just one of those wines. And this kind of belies that logic, and it's still priced fairly. It's mm-hmm. not, I think it's $12 or $13 wholesale, which makes it under $20 for retail. But, I mean, this is kind of the sweet spot, and I mean, not to plug our own game, but I think that's really where the market's at. And, you know, again, we do things that I think are consumer driven, and hopefully they reward us with their dollars.
Yeah. Do you find that now that you're merged with Noble House and you have a greater portfolio, you are able to better service the needs of a restaurant's wine list with your whole portfolio as opposed to just the Barter House portfolio? So was that one of the goals, that if you were presented with the option to kit out a restaurant wine list and you could fulfill all of those needs from one book?
Well, yeah, I think that's obviously the goal and that where we're headed. And it really does help us a lot, because we had sort of niche products that everyone liked. But once they saw them the first couple of times, they're like, okay, I know what you have, and you're not a core buy for us. You're this sort of fun, esoteric, intrinsically funky buy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we got every quarter, you know, we had a restaurant would pick something up from us. But now we can go back week in and week out, because the book is a lot broader. And if they want to talk about, you know, Argentine wines, we have them. If they want to talk about French wines, we have them. If they want to talk about, you know,
Austrian, new one that I just tasted.
Yeah. Those are delish.
The Hillander wines, yeah. Mm.
So we have 5 Austrian producers now, which is something new to the book. So it's all exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for bringing this. This is really nice.
Well, I'm happy to enjoy it with you.
And we are going to end up signing off. So if there's anything that you'd like to point our listeners to, please do so now.
Keep buying your heritage turkeys, because mine was delicious.
Yeah, very nice. What'd you make it with?
Big bucket of spuds, and we did roasted cauliflower,
uh-huh.
and then a turnip, glazed turnips, which were really
ooh,
interesting. So yeah, it was a very root vegetable kind of.
Was this your first heritage turkey that you'd cooked with?
It is not.
No, it's not. Okay.
It is not. I have an inside track to the turkey farm.
Excellent. You know? where are you going to be having for Christmas Day meal?
I think we're going to branch out and do roasted pork.
Pork. Excellent.
Roast crown of pork. So that's going
to
be.
Anything in your head that you'd like to drink aside that?
Something from southern France, or maybe even Italy.
Or if mysteriously a bottle of 89 Opryon shows up at your doorstep, that could work too.
If you walk in with that bottle, there's a place at the table for you, my dear.
Well, cheers. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. I'll see you soon.
Indeed. And thank you to our producer, Jack Inslee. And our sponsor, as you noted before, is the Barter House. Merry Christmas to everyone, and we will be joining back at the Heritage Radio Network the first week of January after the new year. So take care and merry, merry.
El antifaz que tu maldad cubría cayó para exhibir.